Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. As we approach the part of the baseball season during which the teams that shouldn't be contending are supposed to trade their best players to teams that are contending, or at least politely step aside, numbers of alleged also-rans are refusing to cooperate. Before they lost an extra-inning game Wednesday night, the Tampa Bay Devil Rays had won 12 games in a row. The Milwaukee Brewers have stubbornly refused to let the Cardinals and the Cubs run away from them. Here to discuss unlikely contenders and various other baseball matters is ESPN's Tim Kirkjian. Tim, welcome back to Only a Game.
How are you, Bill?
Very well, thank you. One of the sad sack squads that did follow form this week is the Kansas City Royals. The Royals traded center fielder Carlos Beltran to the Houston Astros on Thursday. It's too bad the Astros don't have any starting pitching. Otherwise, they'd be a favorite to win it all, right?
Well, the Astros, amazingly to me, have been a very poor offensive club for at least the last month. And it's stunning because they should have a great lineup. That's why they went to get Carlos Beltran. That and because they know this is probably the last year that this Astro team is going to be together and the last chance they're going to have to win for a while. They are putting everything they have into this season with the expectations this high. They have to win. That's why they traded Richard Hidalgo a couple of weeks ago, because he wasn't hitting and they couldn't wait for him. And when Carlos Beltran came available, they went and got him. And I'm told that took less than a day from the time they got in it to the time they completed it.
Tim, the commissioner has said that a new home for the Expos would be decided upon by the end of July. Is that timetable still in effect? And if so, where do you think the team that's currently selling about 25% of its tickets will end up?
Well, I think end of July is likely. It could drag on to September, so not to demoralize the Expo fans even more, knowing, yes, our team is definitely gone. I don't know if you can demoralize them any more than they are
say,
right now.
Who are they? Where are they? Where have they been?
They're not showing up. That's obvious. Todd Helton told us last year that he's never seen a fan catch a foul ball in Montreal, because there's so few of them, they're so spread out, no one has time to run into a ball and actually catch it. Having said that, I think the Expos are going to move to Washington, D.C., because I just don't think there is another option. There is a stadium in Washington, D.C. where they could move into for next season. They'll build a state-of-the-art place either in downtown Washington or, I think, more likely in Virginia. And I think that franchise will be a very healthy one as soon as they get out of Montreal. That's what I think is going to happen, but I never trust Major League Baseball on this issue.
Tim, things are tough in Montreal, of course, and in Pittsburgh as well. But am I wrong in concluding at this point that there are an awful lot of teams that just don't understand now that they're supposed to be bad?
Well, yes. The teams like the Devil Rays are supposed to be bad. Lou Piniella warned us in spring training we are not finishing last, and guys like myself kind of laughed and said, who are you going to beat? Well, now I see two teams that the Devil Rays
maybe
can beat.
More.
They have had an amazing story. The last team that was 18 under games under 500 at any point of any season and came back to 500 at any point of that season, that happened in 1899. And the Devil Rays have a chance to do that this year, which is just astounding to me. The Brewers are another team that I saw in spring training, and even though I liked what I saw and I liked the direction, I did not see them being this close this late in the season. So this is the beauty of baseball, Bill. Teams get really good and surprise us in a hurry, and in the case of the Kansas City Royals, they get really bad in a hurry.
Speaking of oddities this season, Tim, what are the chances that Barry Bonds won't win the National League batting title, not because he doesn't hit well enough, but because he doesn't get enough official at-bats?
Well, as we know, Bill, it's based on plate appearances, so all he needs are 502 plate appearances, not official at-bats. So, luckily, when he draws his 260th walk this year, 58 more than he's ever had, than anyone's ever had, it's not going to affect him in the batting race. And I think he's going to win the batting title, because with those 260 walks, all he needs is about 115 hits, and he's going to win the batting title because he's going to hit 370 with those hits. It's an amazing thing what's going on with him. I've never seen it. Nobody has ever seen the way that Barry Bonds has been pitched this year. He's over 50 intentional walks this year. If we just included his intentional walks, not the other ones, he'd be in the top five in walks in his league. He already has more intentional walks this year than Alex Rodriguez has in his career, and we're not even to July yet.
One of the more welcome stories this season has been the performance of Ken Griffey Jr. in Cincinnati. If he had been healthy enough the previous 3 years to play the way he's playing now, we would be talking about Jr. the way people are talking about Bonds, right?
Absolutely, Bill. He would be, I think, well over 600 home runs, not just getting to 500 home runs. That's how many home runs he's missed with the injuries the last few years. And yes, before the last 3 years, he was undoubtedly on pace to break Hank Aaron's record. Now, in my opinion, Barry Bonds is going to break it. But the most important thing I've seen from him, Bill, is, as corny as it sounds, I think his smile is back finally. And I think he's a changed Ken Griffey Jr. He seems to be enjoying himself this year for the first time in a long time.
Tim, assuming the most ancient baseball truism holds, the teams that eventually will pull away from the pack will do so on the strength of pitching. Which are your most likely candidates?
Well, that's why I still think the Red Sox and the Yankees have a chance to be good, because their pitching hasn't been close to as good as it should be, and I have to think they're going to pitch better the rest of the season, which is why I still think they're going to be the two best teams in the American League before it's over. In the National League, I really have to think that the Cubs, once Kerry Wood comes back, are going to have the best pitching in the National League, and therefore that is going to be enough to take them to the division title over both Houston and St. Louis. I also think Philadelphia hasn't pitched its best this year, and pretty soon that's going to happen. And in the NL West, I have no idea what's going on in that division. I have no idea how the Giants are in first place at this point. So I can't even point to pitching in that division and say, this team's pitching is going to get better. They're going to win the division. I can't figure that division out.
Tim Kirkjian, being extraordinarily honest and forthright with us today, talks and writes about baseball for ESPN and joins me from time to time on Only a Game. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Bill.
Yeah. Whatever.
It was not possible to conduct radio interviews on Wednesday afternoon in the visiting clubhouse at Fenway Park, where the Minnesota Twins were preparing to play the Boston Red Sox. That's because a dozen of the Twins were watching the video of Pulp Fiction at high volume, so the air was full of four-letter words that would have made it to tape. When Twins outfielder Torrey Hunter wandered away from the movie and made his way out to the dugout, I asked him if viewing Pulp Fiction was his team's favorite way to prepare for a game. No, he said, that tape was just in the machine. Then I asked if he felt there was a perfect way to prepare for a game.
No, there's no perfect way. You know, whatever way is working for you right then and there. You know, baseball players are so superstitious that they might come in and drink some coffee and get wired and crack jokes. And if they get some hits, they're going to do the same thing they did that same day.
I heard a story one time about a guy who went on a terrific hitting streak starting the night that he had Chinese food and drank tequila. And he said when the hitting streak finally ended, he was awful glad because he was afraid he was going to die.
You see, there you go, right there. That lets you know that baseball players are superstitious. If you go eat Chinese food one day and you go get three hits, you're doing it the next day, and you keep that streak going, you'll be Chinese food out, but you got to eat it.
Or you got to watch Pulp Fiction again, since the Twins won on Wednesday night, 4-2, stretching their lead over the White Sox in the Central Division of the American League to 2 games. You'd think that a first-place team would draw pretty well, but that hasn't been the case with the Twins, who've actually played before bigger crowds on the road this season. The playoff success of the NBA's Minnesota Timberwolves was blamed for low turnouts at the Metrodome in the spring, and some folks have said the minor league St. Paul Saints have been more entertaining than the Twins and have stolen some fans. But Torrey Hunter has another explanation.
We have a lot of things going on within our organization that a lot of fans really don't like. You know, they think that, you know, our owners are stealing money from those guys or trying to make money and this and that.
You mean with a new ballpark plan?
New ballpark and trying to get a new television network for himself and stuff like that. So we got too much going on right now.
Hunter's fellow outfielder Jacques Jones feels there's no mystery in why so many fans have stayed home.
Obviously, they feel like there's something better to do. They don't want to be cooped up in the Metrodome, which I don't really blame them.
Recent efforts to replace the Dome have stalled, at least temporarily, but Torrey Hunter is not one to dwell on bad news. That's because he remembers worse times.
Trust me, I was there in 97 and 98 when we were getting like, 8,000, 9,000. I can hear a whole conversation of what somebody did the night before. So
you mean in the batter's box, you could hear him talking.
Yeah, you can hear him talking. And so believe me, we are a lot better. We won the last two division. We might get 15, 20,000. That's packed for us. So we're really having fun with it, and it's only going to get better.
Torrey Hunter's optimism may be justified. The Twins have reclaimed their spot at the top of the division despite injuries that might have discouraged a less resilient team. Shannon Stewart, who finished fourth in the most valuable player voting last season while hitting 307, has been out for much of the season with a foot injury. He hopes to be back in the lineup by the All-Star break. His return will give Minnesota increased pop at the top of the order. In the clubhouse, once Pulp Fiction had been replaced on the big screen by a ball game, Stewart was modest about his comeback expectations.
When I come back, I like to make some contact. That's all, go out there and just don't embarrass myself. But, it's baseball. I'm sure on the comeback it's going to take a few days to get used to what I was doing out there. But hopefully I can catch on quicker.
That the Twins have managed as well as they have with only one regular, Lou Ford, Stewart's replacement, hitting over 300 speaks well for team defense, which has ranged from consistent to spectacular. This evening, the Twins host the Milwaukee Brewers in interleague play at the Metrodome. It's 18 minutes past the hour. In order to distract inmates in the prisons from betting on the European Soccer Championships, officials in Thailand recently gave some of those inmates an opportunity to play soccer against a team of elephants. The prisoners scored first, but the elephants, guided by their riders, were undiscouraged. They are not the best players because they are quite slow, but they try their best, reported Patarampoon Mipan, whose father owns a preserve called the Elephant Palace. The elephants reportedly benefited from the use of an oversized ball and from the absence of a rule preventing them from using their trunks. The final score of the match was 5-5, and not a single prisoner was crushed into the mud like a bug. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Women of the Mat. But first, if IOC President Jacques Roga is right, the Athens Games in August might not be the best Olympics ever. But if the worst fears of meteorologists come true, the Games could be the hottest. While the average temperature at the Summer Olympics in Sydney hovered near a cool 64 degrees, athletes in Athens can expect an average high in the 90s and notoriously bad air quality. To make matters worse, in March, organizers scrapped plans for a roof to shade competitors at the main swimming pool, saying the work couldn't be completed in time. While American sprinters like Michael Phelps don't expect the sun and heat to slow them down, distance swimmers like Larson Jensen, who holds the American record for the 800-meter free, might have more cause for concern. Larson Jensen joins us on the line from Southern California. Larson, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, am I right? Will the lack of a roof be tougher on you and your competition than it will be on the sprinters?
I think so, because we're in the water longer. It'll definitely be a lot hotter for us. We swim for 15 minutes, whereas other people swim for a minute or maybe even under. But I'm really not too worried about it. I train outside every day, and I'm pretty used to it being from Southern California.
So although it wasn't in the plan to swim in an outdoor pool, the news that that would be the case didn't change your training or your approach?
No, sir, it did not. Just kept focus on the goal, and I think most people really don't have a problem with training outdoors or swimming in a meet outdoors. There have been Olympic Games that have been outdoors, you know, forever.
Mm-hmm.
We've had great meets outdoors. 2 years ago in Fort Lauderdale, we had just an awesome meet the United States did. It was our selection meet for the Pan Pacs and the World Championships. You know, Michael Phelps swam awesome. I swam very well. And just everyone really can step it up, whatever the occasion, I think. And obviously, with an indoor facility, you have a lot better climate control, and you can control the pool temperature a lot better, and it's probably more comfortable, but I think once you get in there and start racing, the last thing on your mind is discomfort from heat. I think you're just, you know, in the zone, excited to compete and excited to be at the Olympic Games.
Well, you're making me feel very confident about these Olympics as far as the swimming is concerned, so thank you very much.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me.
Swimmers, especially those who grew up in Southern California, might not be too worried about the sun at the main swimming pool, but in more temperate climes, it's a little tougher to prepare for the heat. Athletes in Great Britain, where it's generally cool, and in Australia, where it's currently wintertime, have taken to training inside giant heat chambers that can simulate the conditions of an August day in Athens. There's even a heat chamber at Hartbury College in Gloucester, where members of the British Olympic equestrian team, both two- and four-legged, are preparing for the games. But heat isn't the only factor athletes will be facing in Athens. Selection committees also need to set their sights on athletes who can handle the dreaded Athens smog. To that end, 2 weeks ago, USA Cycling held its selection race in Redlands, California, one of the smoggier places this country has to offer. Andy Lee, Director of Communications for USA Cycling, was on hand for that effort. Andy, I have to know, was Redlands as hot and smoggy as you hoped it would be?
Well, it was definitely as smoggy as we expected it to be. You know, we've raced at the Redlands Bicycle Classic, which just celebrated its 20th anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
So the cycling community is very familiar with the Redlands area and the conditions that it offers. Heat-wise, it wasn't as bad as we had expected. Earlier in the morning, we held a women's road race, and the conditions there were a little bit cooler than we had expected. But by the time the men took the course, it was hot.
It's got to seem to an outsider a bit cruel to expose athletes to harsh conditions on purpose at the trials. Were the organizers just being mean, or is there really some advantage to be gained here?
Well, there's definitely an advantage. You know, when we laid out the courses and picked the cities and so on and so forth for the event, we wanted to have an event that closely mirrored the conditions of Athens,
mm-hmm.
Not only with the heat and humidity and the smog, but also in terms of distances and profiles and so on and so forth. Out of those trials came three Olympians, Jason McCartney, who was the winner of the men's road race, and Kristen Armstrong, who was the winner of the women's road race, and Christine Thorburn, who was the winner of the women's time trial. By them winning under those conditions on those courses in quality fields, you know, suggests that come Athens, they're going to be potential medalists.
I can't help but notice that while some members of the team were sweating it out there in the smog and the heat, or relative heat, in Southern California, Lance Armstrong, whose spot on the Olympic team was already assured, was breathing nice, clean mountain air in Europe. Now, does this mean Lance will actually be at a disadvantage when the Olympics roll around?
I don't think so. I think, you know, Lance's success is well documented. And, you know, if you look at the tour of last year alone, the temperatures were, you know, well into the hundreds.
Mm-hmm.
So I think everybody all around would be fine come at it.
Andy Lee, thank you very much for joining me.
All right, thank you.
Once the athletes arrive in Athens, they'll have to deal with the heat whether they're ready for it or not. Manufacturers have come out with the latest innovations in heat and sweat-friendly uniforms, and when that's not enough, members of the Scottish Sprint cycling team say they'll plunge their hands into buckets of cold water to cool their blood. For a less brisk alternative, John Surrey, president of Arctic Heat USA, is supplying cooling vests to various U.S. teams for use at the games. John, what exactly is a cooling vest?
It looks just like a vest, no sleeves, zip up front. It's worn skin tight. It doesn't interfere with movement. And you activate this vest, and it keeps your skin cool, cooling your core body temperature down. You can reach maximum cooling temperature within 5 minutes by just in dipping the vest into an ice slurry.
All right, but obviously the athletes can't actually wear these vests while competing.
No, you know, not actually why they're competing, especially in professional competitive sports. the vest is used to either pre-event cool, so you're actually dropping your core body temperature down, allowing your heart to work harder for your muscles before you're actually ready to compete. The vest is also used during recovery. So let's talk about boxers or tennis players or the swimmers when they're just finished a heat and they jump out of the pool and they have to sit in the hot weather and they're getting ready to go in for another one and they want to recover. You just slip a vest on and 2 to 3 minutes, this person with a vest is recovered while the other person without one may not recover fully.
Now, it strikes me that it's going to be hot on the medals stand, among other places in Athens. So if some of these athletes come up to get their medals and they've got their cooling vests on, it strikes me that you may have a real spike in sales after the games.
That would be a wonderful thing if they felt hot from when they were getting. Hopefully the person that uses our vest will be pulling out a gold. So when they're going up to get the gold medal, I think the last thing they're thinking about is how hot it is.
John Suri, thank you very much for joining me.
Okay, thanks so much.
The only new event at the Olympic Games in Athens this summer will be women's freestyle wrestling. The U.S. Women's Olympic Wrestling Team consists of 4 athletes who wrestled against men in high school and in college. John Kalish met with the team as it trained in New York this week, and he has this report.
The wrestlers worked out at Monsignor Farrell High School on Staten Island. To help simulate the steamy conditions expected in Athens, the air conditioning was shut off. In a small office next to the wrestling room sat Bill Crum, executive director of New York's Metropolitan Wrestling Association, and a longtime referee who has worked many matches at the national championships over the years.
4 of our best female wrestlers in the world are in that room. 3 of the 4 were world silver medalists last year. The 4th one beat a world silver medalist to make the team.
The last wrestler to whom Crum refers is Taylor O'Donnell, who competes in the 55-kilogram or 121-pound class. O'Donnell stunned U.S. national champion Tina George by pinning her in 2 consecutive matches at the Olympic trials held in Indianapolis last month. O'Donnell credits her rural lifestyle in Homer, Alaska, with putting her on the path to wrestling.
My mom is really physical. She works with her hands. She built our house. So when I was little, I carried all the food to the animals and rode horses and chopped firewood and wrestled my sheep. Yeah, so I think it just really lends itself to wrestling, all that lifestyle.
O'Donnell played on the boys' varsity football team in high school. She wrestled for 1 year in college on a women's team. The Alaska native is described by her coach as a great scrambler with explosive moves on the mat. Another member of the women's Olympic wrestling squad with a less-than-traditional high school career is Takara Montgomery of Cleveland, who wrestles in the 72-kilogram class. During the winter of her sophomore year in high school, Montgomery played basketball and wrestled.
I ran from basketball practice straight to wrestling practice, and I had a really tough semester that year, just trying to balance the two, and my coaches didn't get along. Wrestling was a challenge in itself, but I managed my time well, I think, and I just had to try to get my coaches to understand it, and my mom helped them to understand that as well.
Her high school coach, Kip Flanick, is now the wrestling coach at Cumberland College in Williamsburg, Kentucky, where Montgomery is a member of one of only a handful of college varsity squads for women. Sarah McMahon, who will represent the U.S. in the 63-kilogram class, also wrestled in college. She attended Lock Haven University in Pennsylvania. Lock Haven is known as Mattown, USA, and the McMahon family went to wrestling tournaments almost every weekend. Wrestling was McMahon's first sport. She was 14 years old when she began. And even though she lived in Mattown, the notion of girls wrestling was frowned upon.
First, it was pure stubbornness to prove everybody wrong. If I wanted to do it, I don't care if I had to go through hell. I was going to do it. And then after the first year, I just was like, wow, I really like this. The challenge and the fight, you know, it completely sweeps you up.
McMahon says she plans to go back to school for a doctorate in psychology after the Olympics. The 4th member of the women's wrestling team is also going back to school after Athens. Next fall, Patricia Miranda will attend Yale Law School. She already has a master's degree in international relations and a serious interest in conflict resolution, though not on the mat. Miranda will wrestle in the 48-kilogram class. She was elected captain of the boys' wrestling team in high school and won more than half her matches her senior year in high school, But at Stanford University, where she also wrestled on the male team, Miranda won a single match in 5 years of college competition. Looking back, Miranda says the frustration and humiliation she endured in high school and university wrestling resulted in personal growth.
If I was not going to win a match this tournament, I was going to score a takedown, you know, because that's what my life depended on. I was going to score a takedown. You know, so I think it taught me so many things that helped so much along the way, you know, small goal setting, learning how to not get too down on yourself, learning how to motivate yourself, you know, learning how to defend yourself when people laugh at you. All these little things that I think make me a stronger person now.
Shake hands. Make it count. The score is 0-0. You have 4 minutes. Set. Go.
The coach of the U.S. Olympic women's wrestling team, Terry Steiner, says his squad is well prepared for the games in Athens. The major concern is the Japanese team, which bested the U.S. in September's 2003 World Championships. But Steiner acknowledges that Russia, the Ukraine, and Canada are among the countries with strong squads.
We need to have great performances. I'm not going to make any great expectations about how many golds we're going to have or silvers or how many medals we're going to bring home. Obviously, these girls are worthy of a medal and medal contention, but we can't focus on that right now.
No matter how the four female Olympians do on the mat in Athens, Patricia Miranda says the American people will know that, as a sport, women's wrestling has arrived.
What they see in Athens, you know, the excitement, the tragedy and triumph that is sport, you know, the fact that these girls are dedicated and wrestling their hearts out, that's what I think is going to convince the American public that, yeah, women's wrestling is here now. And the message I want to send from Athens isn't so much that every girl should wrestle, you know, but it's that every girl can wrestle now. This is what the world should know, you know, when we're up there on the podium. It's just, hey, you can.
For Only a Game, I'm John Kalish in New York.
You're listening to Only a Game.
Byron was a great follower of boxing, and so was Keats. There's nothing like a really good fight to stimulate good writing. You could go through some of the best fights, one inspires the other.
That's W.C. Hinds, one of the very best writers to have been fascinated by boxing, celebrating the connection between his craft and the sport in a conversation we had a little over 4 years ago. There must be a certain irony in being inducted into a Sports Hall of Fame when you're 89 years old. If there is, Bill Hinds probably smiled at that irony when he was welcomed into the Boxing Hall of Fame 2 weeks ago, though his health prevented him from attending the ceremony in person. According to the Hall's publicists, Mr. Hinds qualified for enshrinement because he wrote brilliantly about boxing, but the fact is that Bill Hinds wrote brilliantly about what it's like to be alive on the planet. Boxing was one of many beneficiaries of Bill's curiosity, his sense of humor, his exceptional ear, and his determination to tell stories worthy of the people fortunate enough to intrigue and delight him. Baseball was another beneficiary, and so was horse racing. Bill's dispatches from the Second World War are gems of understatement, and with a surgeon who'd served in Korea, he co-wrote the novel MASH under the pseudonym Richard Hooker. I had the good fortune to meet Bill Hinds 3 years ago when DeCapo Press reissued some of his books, which had been out of print for years. Among the works was a 1958 novel entitled The Professional, which is set in boxing. The Professional ends in a defeat that seems surprising and unfair. The first time I talked with Bill in person, I asked him if he'd been tempted to write a more cheerful ending. No, he told me, because that's not the way it happens. I don't watch boxing. I think the news this week that Mike Tyson, 38, intends to fight again is only the most recent bit of evidence that the alleged sport is currently foul in its appeal, thoroughly corrupt, and brutal beyond sensible tolerance. But if news of the induction of Bill Hines into the Boxing Hall of Fame encourages somebody to read something Bill wrote, the result will justify the existence of the place, and it'll have to serve until somebody puts together a Writer's Hall of Fame and plunks Bill Hines into that. When that happens, the odds are excellent that Mr. Hines won't take the honor or himself seriously. I suggest this because a couple of months ago, after I'd sent him a postcard featuring a painting by Paul Gauguin, Bill wrote in reply, "I like Gauguin, too. He was another guy who knew how to beat the old 9-to-5.
Rabbit said to the bee, "What makes you sting so deep?" "Bee say I sting like Joe and rock 'em all to sleep."
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, a tale of two tennis players. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's sports news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
It's usually possible to judge which teams have improved themselves after any given NBA draft, but I don't think that's the case with Thursday's draft because it included more high schoolers than ever, as well as many underclassmen and some international players. You agree with me?
Foreigners and children, that's your NBA draft these days. Although, interestingly enough, Bill, 8 of the first 10 picks were people who had gone to American colleges, and 11 of the first 20. I think the fact that Dwight Howard went ahead of Emeka Okafor is an interesting thing, as is the fact that Ben Gordon, who I do not think is the third best player available in the draft, went third. Then I go down, Bill, and I see that 21, 22, and 23 are all from a school called Russia. Is that a Big Ten school? I mean, the obvious, you know, similarities between Columbus, Ohio, and Stalingrad, you know, aside, is Russia a Big Ten school?
Absolutely. Or it will be soon. No NBA teams, the 2004 champion Detroit Pistons included, seem to be content with their lot because the Pistons and just about every other team is alleged to have come up with a package to offer the Lakers for the big Aristotle, a.k.a. Shaq Diesel, who apparently wants out of L.A., Is the balance of the NBA about to shift dramatically?
It will shift only if the big Aristotle decides to take his act east. If he winds up in Sacramento or Dallas, it won't. The balance of power will still be in the Western Conference. You know, the other interesting thing, of course, is that Kobe Bryant becomes a free agent in the middle of July, and that will in and of itself disrupt the Lakers plentifully. But it will make it a little bit easier, I think, if they want to keep him, if they manage to unload Shaquille before then.
Among the other top-tier players rumored to be moving soon are Orlando's Tracy McGrady, Boston's Paul Pierce, and perhaps every Dallas Maverick except for Dirk Nowitzki. I wonder if the NBA's offseason might be more exciting than the past season was.
Well, I mean, it is going to be a very interesting offseason. The whole thing is energized by the fact that the Lakers are breaking up, obviously, and there are two of the five best players in the league, including a player who can walk into any franchise just about in the middle to upper tier and make it an NBA championship contender. And there are a lot of teams, especially in the West, who've been trying to win for a while. It is time to break up this particular group of Dallas Mavericks because they're not going to win the championship with them.
The expansion Charlotte Bobcats chose Emeka Okafor at number 2, as well as 19 players in Tuesday's expansion draft. Will NBA fans in the Queen City be rooting for a winner right away or pining for Dwight Howard?
No, but what they did do is they did take a lot of players who are in the last year or the second or next to last year of their contract, which means the Charlotte Bobcats are going to have a lot of salary cap room to play with over the next two off seasons.
Charlie, on Thursday, the San Francisco Chronicle reported that in grand jury testimony last fall, sprinter Tim Montgomery alleged Victor Conti supplied Barry Bonds with performance-enhancing drugs. Since it is illegal to give grand jury testimony to the media, Should we conclude, as Montgomery's attorneys have, that USADA is resorting to McCarthyism?
Well, USADA is resorting to dirty prosecutorial tactics. I mean, McCarthyism is kind of a baggy word that can include almost everything. This is proof positive that Marion Jones was right to demand a public hearing, that anybody who chooses to leave their fate in the hands of the urine-sniffing yahoos of the USADA is fooling themselves.
It took 4 months, but British Columbia officials have finally brought charges against Vancouver Canucks star Todd Bertuzzi for sucker-punching Colorado's Steve Moore. Bertuzzi may face jail time, but why should this operation have taken so long to unfold?
I'm not exactly sure. I think perhaps in part because Steve Moore is still recovering. I think the Vancouver, the provincial prosecutor is being very, very careful about this one because I think, frankly, they mean it this time.
Venus Williams lost her second-round match at Wimbledon due in part to the lack of proper scorekeeping. This isn't supposed to happen at the world's most famous tennis
tournament. That doesn't happen. Meat pile, Shippen's pile, blah, blah.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about what happened basically was that a line judge called a serve out. This somehow never made it to the guy sitting up in the chair. But the really interesting thing about it is that neither Venus Williams nor Carolina Sprem seemed to notice. And afterwards, Venus said that sometimes she loses track of the score and felt that maybe she just lost track again.
That happens to me when I'm watching tennis quite often. I wake up and find that a set has gone by.
It happens to me when I'm watching soccer, Bill, but generally I just assume that it's 1-0.
Out of bounds, out of bounds, no fair. I was unhappy to see the Tampa Bay Devil Rays' 12-game winning streak end on Wednesday night. Tampa shooting to the top of the AL East would have unhinged fans in both New York and Boston, and that would have been great fun, don't you think?
Well, then they came back and scored 19 runs
and
won 19-13 over Toronto. I'm telling you right now, if you want to see a city start losing its mind, let the Tampa Bay Devil Rays get a couple of games closer to the struggling Boston Red Sox. Oh, my goodness.
Yankees pitcher Jose Contreras reunited this week with his wife and two daughters after they made it from Cuba to Florida in a boat. Was the craft, by any chance, the SS Steinbrenner?
I don't know. This is a nice story. I'm sure there's all kinds of finagling and under-the-table dealing and sub-rosa payoffs involved. You know, it's entirely possible that this will help Jose Contreras, who's been struggling a little bit on the mound. It will help the Yankees. So was there any Steinbrennerian diplomacy involved here? I think it's probably the case, yes.
In the European Soccer Championships, Germany is out, and the Czech Republic is through to round two. They play Denmark tomorrow. The Czech players were no doubt inspired by an offer from a local brewery,
roll
don't you think?
Roll out the barrels. This is
barrels,
really
plural here.
The Bernard Brewery, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, has offered the coach, Carol Bruckner, free beer for the rest of his life if his team wins the Euro Cup 2004. He's offering 60 liters of beer a year, which is apparently equivalent to the average Czech's annual consumption of beer per person, which makes the Czechs, in somewhat of an upset for me, the world's champion beer drinkers. Now, if the Selig family is paying attention, this could really improve the Brewers' chances as the baseball season goes along.
I should think so. I should think there also might be something of an uproar in Australia.
And I really wish I could do a very, very an adequate Homer Simpson imitation to say the words, free beer for life.
And finally, Charlie, Intel has introduced a new surfboard designed to help surfers multitask. Can you describe this technological wonder for us?
Surfing while surfing.
There you
go. You can surf the internet while you're surfing the pipeline. This seems to me to be a little bit, I'm all in favor of this internet thing that's so popular among the kids, but this seems to be a little bit dumb.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he shoots the curl and then surfs the web after joining me each week at this time. Thanks, Charlie.
Free beer for life.
For more on this week's stories, pictures from stories past and present, commentaries galore, and the opportunity to write email to us, check out our website, onlyagame.org. Bruce Schoenfeld's new book, The Match, recounts the stories of two tennis players and the friendship that sustained them. You've heard of one of the players, Althea Gibson. Unless you're a student of Wimbledon history, you may not be familiar with Ms. Gibson's sometimes doubles partner and longtime friend, Angela Buxton. Mr. Schoenfeld joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Bruce, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks so much, Bill.
Althea Gibson, winner of 11 major singles and doubles titles between 1956 and 1958, was black. No matter how well she played, there were clubs she couldn't join and various other places where she wasn't welcome. And I gather that because she was Jewish, Angela Buxton faced the same problem, especially in England 50 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, we always have to be careful. You can't compare the life of a Jewish woman growing up in 1950s England to an African-American in the late 40s and early 50s. They're not analogous. But tennis is a country club sport, and especially at that time, the major tournaments were played at private clubs, the practice facilities, the coaches were all at private clubs, and the nature of private clubs is exclusionary. You wouldn't have a private club if not to keep someone else out, right? It would just be a public facility. So most of these clubs did not allow Jews as members, did not allow blacks as members. And the one interesting twist, Angela traveled across the country to go to Los Angeles, to the Los Angeles Tennis Club, because she felt surely in America she could get the best facilities, only to find out that it didn't admit Jews either.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, she had a way of landing on her feet and ended up getting private lessons from Bill Tilden on Charlie Chaplin's court. So
Not too shabby. When Gibson and Buxton won the doubles championship at Wimbledon nearly 50 years ago, neither of them was especially interested in being cast as a champion of her people. Why was that?
Well, I think for Althea especially, she felt that it was diminishing. She really had a lifelong struggle to get what she thought was the recognition she deserved, and she felt that by being characterized, pigeonholed as an African-American champion, it detracted from her status as a champion. And she would go around and say, you know, you don't call so-and-so a white tennis champion, do you? So why would you call me a Negro tennis champion? And almost like she wanted to make it clear she was playing in the major leagues and not just wasn't just the best player of her race. She was one of the best players in the world.
It's intriguing that the event that you say elevated the friendship between these two players to a higher level occurred during a match that Gibson and Buxton were playing against each other. Tell us that story.
The semifinal of the 1956 French Championships, the precursor to the French Open, and you had on either side of the net a player for whom advancing to a final of a major tournament would be a major accomplishment. For Althea, it would represent the first black of any country, of either gender, to get to the final of a major. And for Angela, it would be this triumph over all these people who said, oh, she has no talent, oh, she's just that gawky Jewish girl. Both of them really wanted to advance. After splitting the first two sets, and I want to point out, Althea was really the better player all the way through. But Angela was game and plucky, and she had the crowd on her side because Althea was perceived as arrogant. After splitting the first two sets, Althea was serving in the third set, and her bra strap broke. And Angela rushed around from the other side of the net to shield her friend and kind of hustle her off as the crowd hooted. They were really anti-Althea to begin with, and those French crowds can be tough. And when they emerged, there was a conference going on, and they wanted to disqualify Althea for leaving the court. Now, both of the players had left the court, but they realized if they disqualified both of them, they wouldn't have a final to play. So they said, let's disqualify Althea because she caused this anyway. And Angela, all you have to do is say, okay, you're right, it was a rules violation, I'm going to accept this disqualification. She would have been a finalist. And Angela refused to do that. So, you know, in Angela's mind, she said, listen, this is my friend. I don't want to get there by disqualification. But more than that, Althea deserves it. Let's play it out on the court, and if Althea wins, so be it. And I think Althea realized then that Angela's motives were very pure. And from then on, I think the friendship really ascended to a higher level, and I think later in her life, when Althea turned to Angela in times of need, that's what was going through her head.
Hmm. It would be easy to conclude that the reason Althea Gibson didn't have a lot of friends on the tennis tour was that she was different. She was working class and poor, as well as black, but I gather that other players, even some of her doubles partners, were put off by various other characteristics that she had. You spoke of arrogance, for example.
Well, you know, Althea, in a way, is the precursor to the modern athlete, the modern female athlete. In those days, you had people who weren't getting rich on the tennis tour. They weren't getting famous in most cases. what they had was this sort of rolling sorority party, this quality of life. And they'd come to net at the end of a match and they'd say to each other, well, you were just the finer player today. Oh, no, no, don't be silly. I got fortunate. Althea couldn't afford such niceties. You know, she was a competitor. She had to scrape and claw. She'd come to the net after losing a match and she couldn't understand it. She'd look the other player in the eye and she'd say, I'll get you next time. That did not go over well. Angela was much the same way. She was not that talented and she really persevered. There's a wonderful scene relayed to me by some players who were on a tour with her in India in 1956. In fact, the tour where she really got to know Althea. The heat of the midday sun, and stereotypically, you know, it's mad dogs and Englishmen. Well, here's this English woman striding out at noon in Calcutta in the absolute heat of the day to get a tennis lesson with some sergeant major. The players on the tour were sitting around in the lobby saying, this woman's insane. But it was that singularity of purpose that put off the other players, but that carried Angela to the same heights.
Tell me a little bit about what it was specifically, once Gibson and Buxton had moved beyond tennis, that kept their friendship alive and so vibrant.
I think it was more almost the memory of the camaraderie they'd shared. In a strange way, it was the female sports equivalent of being in a foxhole together. You know, they had both faced these common odds, stared down this adversity. It's funny, Angela swears she remembers, and I looked hard for this, she swears she remembers the morning after she and Althea won the Wimbledon doubles champion, a black from South Carolina via Harlem, a Jew from North London. She swears she remembers a headline in one of the London papers that said, Minorities Win. And that was the mindset. And so when you've been through that together, when you were outsiders to such a degree, I think that stays with you for the span of a life.
The story of Althea Gibson's final years could have been pathetic. In fact, you suggest that when she called Angela Buxton 9 years ago, Gibson was on the brink of suicide. How did Buxton respond to that situation?
Althea called and said, Angie, I just want to say goodbye. You know, I'm destitute. I have mounting bills. I'm ill. I can't buy my medicines every month. And I just don't want to live like this. I'm too proud to really be seen or be known as someone living in this terrible condition. I'm calling to say goodbye. And Angela, much as she'd done on the court through the years, helping out during a rally, she said, "No, no, no, you're not. I'm gonna pitch in. I'm gonna make sure. How much money do you need? What can we do?" And she put her mind to it with the same singularity of purpose that she had made herself into an athlete, made herself into a tennis champion. And she was tireless, raising money and visiting the tennis community and beyond to not just save Althea's life, so to speak, but also resurrect her reputation. I think that if we're here today talking about these two remarkable women, it's because of who Althea Gibson was. But we wouldn't be here if not for what Angela Buxton did.
Bruce Schoenfeld is the author of The Match, Althea Gibson and Angela Buxton, How Two Outsiders, One Black, the Other Jewish, Forged a Friendship and Made Sports History, published by Amistad. Bruce, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thanks so much.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again or sign up for our newsletter, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from author Bruce Schoenfeld, who recalls the worst question ever directed toward him regarding The Match.
Althea Gibson, we all know her, great African-American, but Angela Buxton, she was Jewish, wasn't she?
I'd hope he wouldn't bring that up. I thought it was a pretty good question at the time. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.